Cancer Research UK and also the UCL Cancer Trials Centre in London, and he's going to be giving us a Bayesian talk on Model 3 approach to combination therapy phase 1 trials using censored time to toxicity data.
Brilliant.
That's great.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me along and for having me, and for dinner as well, Peter. It was a pleasure. As Peter already said, so I'm based at UCL at the CRUK Cancer Trials Centre. I've been there for about 3 years. Prior to that, I was at the MRC Biostats Unit for a PhD and a short postdoc as well. So this is some joint work which was recently published in JRSSC, along with Michael Sweeting from the University of Leicester, and also Adrian Mander, who's sat in tonight. Thanks for coming. Who's based in the Biostats Unit as well. So I'm just going to give you a bit of an introduction. I'm not sure what backgrounds you guys have and what you're all in, but I'm going to talk a little bit about phase one clinical trials, what they are and what the aims of them are. And then I'm going to basically sort of move on to the methodology that we've published in our paper through an example trial called ORCA-2. So there we go. Yeah, so ORCA-2, which we're running from our department, give you a bit of background as to how that's designed, and then move on to the extension that, that I've been doing some work on. And then some simulation work, and then a bit of a summary, and hopefully some discussion questions around it. So just say as well, if you've got, it's a small group here, which is quite nice, if you've got any questions or comments or during the meeting itself, feel free to ask. So for those who don't know, so phase one trials are basically sort of the first investigation of a new drug or a drug for a new purpose in human beings. Clinical trials are generally being used, at least in oncology, to try and find a safe dose of a particular treatment. Ideally with some sort of efficacy signal that you might take forward into larger comparative trials. So I work mainly in oncology, and for those sorts of trials, your typical phase one trial is a really small study, it's single arm, we're not doing any randomization or comparing to another drug. You're going to have maybe sort of a handful of patients, could easily be 12 to 15, up to perhaps 40 or 50. And a lot of these patients in cancer trials will have exhausted standard therapy. So they're sort of limited life expectancy, and this is an avenue where we could get some data from them in terms of how informative or how safe this treatment is, but also give them a potential avenue for recovery. So the idea is that basically patients come onto your trial, you give them this new treatment at a set dose, and then you see how they do. You observe whether they get any nasty side effects, whether they tolerate the treatment, and then based on that data, you decide whether you're going to change the dose that you're giving them. So are you going to increase it because actually it's tolerable, or have you seen some nasty side effects and you think, well, actually we're going to decrease the dose for the next patient or the next group of patients that comes in. And that's basically it. It's a dose modifying trial that we're doing. And our aim traditionally in most of these trials is to find something called the maximum tolerated dose, or the MTD for short. So there's a couple of definitions floating around about this, but the one that's often used is this one down here. So the MTD is basically the dose of a treatment that's expected to produce some degree of medically unacceptable dose-limiting toxicity, or toxicity for short, in a specified proportion of patients. So that could be 20%, 30%, 35%. So first off, what is DLT? I'll just quickly come on to that. So DLT, dose-limiting toxicities, it's basically a way of saying whether an adverse event experienced by a patient is too severe or not. So I've just got this example here. This is from some the NCI's common terminology criteria, where we're looking at blood and lymphatic system disorders. They're graded from 1 to 5, 1 being not that severe, 5 being death. And a blanket statement might be that any adverse event that's grade 3 or higher is a dose-limiting toxicity. And you can obviously be a bit more specific and say, well, actually, any grade 3 or higher adverse event is dose-limiting, but actually we will allow grade 3 anemia, and you can tailor the definition of that. So that's basically what we're dealing with. It's severe toxicity. So thinking from a sort of starting to get a bit more numerical, a dose-limiting toxicity is usually recorded as a binary response. So whilst we've got all that grading stuff there, it's commonly the case that we're looking at binary response. Do you have a DLT or not? Yes or no? And we make some common assumptions in these sorts of trials. So the idea is that as we increase the dose of this treatment, then the risk of toxicity or the risk of DLT is also increasing. And traditionally with cytotoxic drugs, we're also assuming that toxicity is indicative of some sort of action, some sort of efficacy happening. So essentially, as you're increasing the dose of a treatment, then maybe there's an increased chance of an efficacy response being observed as well. So as I've said, our aim is to basically gradually increase this dose of this treatment, getting new patients in, seeing if they have side effects or not, until we are fairly sure we've found a maximum tolerated dose, that is a dose that has, for example, an expected risk of DLT of 20%. So we're looking at something like this. This is a nice quick plot to show it. We've got a 20% target toxicity level here, this red line. Imagine that this blue line is our dose toxicity relationship, denoting the risk of DLT at different doses, and lo and behold, this 320 milligram dose here, that's our MTD. So that's basically what you're trying to estimate in a very simple one treatment phase one trial. Okay, so now I'm going to move on to a slightly more complex trial called ORCA-2. So this is being run out of our department at the moment, and this is looking at olaparib in high risk and locally advanced squamous cell head and neck cancers. So the interesting thing about this particular trial is that we are changing the dose of the treatment. So we've got four candidate dose levels, 50, 100, 150 and 200 milligrams. It's given twice daily, but we're also changing the schedule of treatments as well. So this treatment can be given on 3 days, 4 days or 5 days. So we've got two things that we could be adapting. Now, rather than thinking about trying to identify one maximum tolerated dose, we could be thinking about identifying one or more maximum tolerated dose combinations formed of these four doses and the 3 day schedules there. So that's the kind of the general aim of the trial. We've got a target toxicity level of 33%, which is slightly higher than the 20 that I showed you. And we're following patients up for quite a while for observing whether they have DLTs or not, about 14 weeks once they start treatment. So this is the dose schema, basically, of the ORCA-2 trial. So patients will start off, the trial starts off at this dose band one here, 50 milligrams twice daily, given over 3 days. And essentially, the trial proceeds that if that dose is considered tolerable, then patients can then come onto the trial by either a dose where the number of days has been increased to 4 days, or you could be increasing the dosage itself, so 100 milligrams every 3 days. And what we're really looking for in this study is there one, or perhaps even two or three of these combinations that could be considered maximum tolerated doses, and how do you go about finding these? Okay, so this is where we're going to come on to, yes?
How do you deal with patient that's related?
How do we deal with what, sorry?
Patient to patient that's related.
Some patients may be more tolerable than others.
Yeah,
no, that's a really good question. So you are going to have heterogeneous responses across patients. In this particular study, you've got fairly strict eligibility criteria for these sorts of trials based on can they tolerate the treatment, certain performance status scores, predicted life expectancy, what therapies they may or may not have had before. So there's some homogeneity in that sense, but there is going to be a little bit of heterogeneity there as well. So that's not explicitly dealt for in these sorts of studies, or at least in this ORCA-2 trial, it's just kind of looking at an average effect. So coming back to how this trial is actually proceeding at the moment. So the idea is with the PIPE methodology, rather than fitting a model across all of those combinations here and sort of trying to think of a dose toxicity surface, we're going to assume that every single dose combination, dose and days, has an independent probability of causing a DLT. So where we see a pi 2-1 or pi 3-1 here, that is the risk of DLT at that particular combination. So we're assuming that they're all independent at the moment, but they're going to be linked up together in a bit. And we're going to make two assumptions. So the first assumption we're making here is basically that as we increase the dose, the number of days that we're treating patients with this dose, then the risk of DLT is not decreasing. And we're also assuming that that's the same with dosage as well. Okay. So as I said, this is using this approach called PIPE. And basically, we're going to place a beta pi distribution on each of those pi JKs, if you like, that we saw in this thing here, with some of these hyperparameters RJ, K, and SJ. So every single probability has a prior on it. And we're going to collect some data at some point on these different combinations, and we'll go through exactly how that happens in a bit. But the idea is we're going to collect some data on this, and we can just easily update what the prior distribution is for each of those combinations, and get a posterior here. And it's fairly straightforward because it's all beta priors, Bernoulli, binomial beta. So we're just simply looking at the prior hyperparameter there, plus the number of DLTs we see on a combination, and then this is the number of non-DLTs we see. So just showcasing how it's very easy to update the risk of DLT when we get new data. Yes?
How you choose the verbs?
Yeah, absolutely. So, if you've got any information from existing studies, then that could lead to you specifying how these hyperparameters are, because that provides some information on how many patients you may have treated there. But if you just wanted to assume completely sort of uninformative priors, how we did it in our work was that we had some sort of median guess as to what the risk of DLT was at each dose. So that's one part of it. And then we also chose, so as well as the median, we basically chose these so that it would be equal to one patient being treated across the entire dose range. So if you had, we just go back here, so we've got 16 combinations, you imagine there's a 1/16 of a patient's weight on there. So very small numbers, but they can be centred around some sort of median guess.
Expert guesses.
Expected guesses, yeah, with a long
variable. Experts, clinicians guesses.
Clinicians guesses, and that's kind of helped in a lot of trials we do. It's also helped through stats team as well, just thinking about, okay, what are reasonable assumptions about these things, or any other evidence that happens as well. Yeah. Okay. So that just talks about the idea that we're updating independent risks of DLT when we've got some data. But the real question is, well, how are all these things being linked together, and how are we actually driving how to estimate where this maximum tolerated dose combination is? So the way that we went about it, or the way that actually this is sort of Adrian's work really, as well, is thinking about trying to find a maximum tolerated contour. So we can think of that dose grid and day grid as being split up by this blue line here. And doses that have an expected risk of DLT below this line, which represents a 33% target toxicity level, are the safe doses. And anything else that's above it is an unsafe dose or slightly too toxic. Okay. So using the data that we've collected on each of these independent, at each of these dose levels, we want to try and estimate where the most likely contour is. Where's the most likely split between the safe and the unsafe doses? So this is going to go into just some of the mathy bits behind it. We can think that there's a whole bunch of possible contours that could be there, that could actually separate them. So in this example, we've just got the fact that it's just these four doses here, the unsafe ones. But one possible contour is that everything is unsafe. So you could have a line going all the way down there, all the way across there. You could have one where everything is actually safe. So you have a line going all the way down there and all the way down there. And then anything else in between. And each of these contours can be coded up as essentially a binary matrix, where you've got ones representing doses that are above it, and zeros where the doses are below it. Okay. So there's going to be a whole bunch of those contours. Now, we're going to use those pi jk's, those probabilities, the posterior probabilities at each of those doses, and we can work out what the tail probabilities of these distributions are. So that is, what is the probability that the DLT risk at each combination is below our target? Okay, so that will give us these PJKs here. And then we're going to use those tail probabilities in order to work out how likely is it that the maximum tolerated contour is one of those selected possible contours that we can have. So this is just sort of a fairly standard likelihood expression here. For a given contour, this CL we have here, so this element will be a 1 or a 0, depending on whether it's a safe dose or an unsafe dose. So you're essentially going to be factoring in all of those tail probabilities, these PJKs, into here, and for each possible contour, you can work out how likely it is that that's the maximum tolerated contour. And that's the key linking step, really, in terms of getting those independent probabilities of DLT into a maximum tolerated contour, a line that bisects the safe and the unsafe doses. And we can normalise those so that we end up getting a proper distribution, essentially, across all possible contours. So once we're at this stage, we've got a bunch of candidate contours that separate safe and unsafe doses based on data we've already observed. And we say, okay, well, I suppose one approach which we used was, which is the most likely contour given this data we have? And once we have got a guess for what the most likely contour is, that can inform which dose we choose to give to the next patient or group of patients coming into our study. And of course, there might be certain safety constraints you might have in there. You might want you may not want to escalate too quickly through all of your dose levels. And I'll come on to some of those in a second. But that's the real gist of kind of the method that's going on here. So some of the safety or sort of guiding constraints that we might have for choosing doses is that if we've got a selection of combinations and we've got this big thick black line here that denotes the maximum tolerated contour we're using, we're going to choose some doses, or a dose rather, that lies closest to the contour. Because this is what we're trying to target. We're trying to target doses with a risk of toxicity equal to our target, or close to our target, and that's what that line is. So any of these X's is a potential dose. But of course, imagine that we've just started our trial, and if this was our kind of estimated contour and we've been starting to dose patients down here, it'd be a pretty bold leap to start leaping all the way up to here, but you know, by going along three or four levels that way and two levels that way. So we need some extra constraints in there as well to sort of control this sort of thing. So one potential is that we have this dose skipping constraint. So basically, if we have currently administered this dose level here, marked high, then we could reasonably consider going one level up on either axis, or even to this diagonal point here, but outside of that box may be unwise to do. Now this is all fairly sort of trial specific, depends on the study you're actually conducting, but it's not going to be a purely probabilistically driven mechanism when we actually come to conducting this trial. Okay. So I talked about the fact that there could be lots of different contours we could be looking at, and so here's a toy example where we've got six possible contours from two levels of drug A and two levels of drug B. So these are the possible contours we could have. This is a nice way to sort of visualise it. And this is basically showing that from a grid this size, we've got 2^j+k possible contours. So obviously, as you start expanding the grid and if you start considering bigger combinations, we've got 5 levels of drug A and 6 levels of drug B, then that starts to blow up. But this is quite useful for showing this sort of safety constraint. So what we can think of as well is, it's all very well trying to target that maximum tolerated contour, but we may actually want to prevent ourselves from going to a dose that has an average risk of DLT above, way above our target. So if we imagine, for example, we're targeting that 33% level and we've got some weak prior information with these median risks of DLT, these doses, then we can average across all of the possible contours, these 6 contours in this example, and we can basically pull out some average risk of DLT here. So this 0.45 here was basically gained by saying, well, look, we've got a distribution of our contours. We reckon this is the MTC with probability 0.11, this one with 0.17, 0.17, and so on and so forth. And it's just simply summing up where that one is there. So 0.11, 0.17, 0.17, and that gives us 0.45. So this is a way of constructing a safety constraint where we can say, okay, well, if we look at this combination here, that's got an average probability across all of those contours being above our target of about 84%, and that's unsafe. So these are the sorts of things that you can also introduce into a trial if you want to. Okay. So the idea really, so I've gone through sort of building up the contour and using the one we're going to use for decisions. So the trial basically proceeds as identifying that most likely line, that MTC. Given any dose skipping constraints you might have, you can choose the combination that is closest to that maximum tolerated contour, subject to any constraints. And if there's no combinations available, then that's grounds for stopping your trial. And basically, you just repeat this procedure, dosing more and more patients in this way, until you've either exhausted all the patients that you have, or you're reasonably confident that you've found your maximum tolerated dose. And then at that point, you've got a combination that you could take forward to a phase 2 trial. Or in fact, you could have several combinations that you take forward as well. So I'm just going to pause there. Is everyone sort of okay with where we are at the moment? Yeah, some nodding heads and some very statue-like poses, that's fine. Okay. Estimating a line, choosing a dose, carrying on. That's basically what we're doing. Okay. So that's the ORCA-2 trial, and the design has been used for that. And I'm going to sort of talk about an extension to that where it could be potentially handy for trials where you've got very long periods of follow-up. Now in ORCA-2, the clinicians had mentioned that basically it would be nice where, rather than waiting to observe the full amount of DLT follow-up that patients having, which was 14 weeks, could, if patients were being recruited much earlier into our study, could they be allocated to doses even when we haven't got complete follow-up on people? Because at the moment what we're having to do is put a patient onto trial, we either wait the full 14 weeks and declare that they haven't had a dose-limiting toxicity, or we wait until they do have a DLT at some point, and that's when we can use their data to update our probabilities. Now, wouldn't it be nice if perhaps we could actually, during that long period of follow-up, say, okay, well, we've only observed these patients for, you know, 7 weeks, 8 weeks, 9 weeks, and we've got new patients coming in. Given this data that we have, where's the best place to put these patients? Which dose combination should they be receiving? So this is where, drawing on methods that have already been used in some of the early phase literature, in other sort of model-based designs for phase one clinical trials, we drew on using a sort of time-to-event approach and time-to-event endpoints. So some of this terminology has already been listed, but just to get us familiar, so we've got J doses of drug A and K doses of drug B, and dose combinations is denoted by AJ, BK. Where you see NJKT, so T is now our time subscript, that's the number of people on dose combination AJ, BK at time T, and also YIT is our DLT outcome. For patient I. And we make an assumption that basically if a patient has had a DLT at time T, then we consider them as a DLT status, you know, henceforth. They're not coming back onto the study, it won't be resolved for these purposes. And that pi JK that I showed you earlier for all those combinations, for all those computations rather, we're just going to subscript that with a T again. So that is the probability of the DLT occurring at that dose at time T. So what we're going to do now is create essentially a weight for every single patient dependent on how long they've been followed up for. So this is denoted by this WIT, and we can think of this as a partial outcome for that patient who's been given combination AJBK. Now, patients start their treatment at this time I0, TI0, and we'll observe them for some fixed length of time, which I've denoted as capital T here. So basically, this linear weight, I call it linear at the moment because I'll show you an alternative. What this is saying is that we're going to give a patient a weighting of 1 if they have had a DLT during their DLT follow-up. Okay, that's a weight of 1. If they haven't had a DLT yet and they're still being followed up, then the patient weight is a weight that basically goes from 1 down towards 0, and it's a decreasing weight. I'll show you. This is an alternative here. So basically, this linear weight that we've got up here assumes that as patients are being followed up over the DLT window, then DLT would happen at a uniform rate across patients. It may be the case that with your treatment, DLTs are more likely to happen at the very start of your follow-up, or they may be late onset. Is it possible that we can observe patient data as to when people have DLTs and then use that to alter the weight that we would give patients during the trial? Now, this was proposed by Chung and Chappell in 2000 in one of their papers on phase one trials, and this is a kind of rather complicated way of basically saying that we'd use the DLT times from previous patients to learn when patients are most likely to have DLTs. Is it going to be later on, or is it going to be at the start of treatment? Okay. So hopefully this picture will explain it slightly better. So we've got here time on the x-axis for this plot up here, and patient weight here, going up here. And these blue lines that you see going diagonally down, that's the uniform case. So that's basically saying we're assuming that as time goes on, then the risk of or DLTs will occur at a uniform rate. Where you see all these higgledy-piggledy red lines and the black dotted lines going up, this is representing the weighting function under different assumptions. So an interesting one here, looking at this top right corner, is basically saying we've got a lot of toxicity is happening very early on. And so at first the patient weight is a 1. And provided that a patient gets through this sort of forest of DLTs early on in their treatment, then they have a lower weight score here. And similarly, if we look at this late onset example, this is basically saying, okay, well, a patient starts off and they're halfway through their follow-up, and that's all very well and good, but we know that a bunch of people have had loads of DLTs later on in their treatment cycle. So they haven't quite made it through. And this is essentially sort of the adaptive weighting function. We're going to stick in our work with this uniform example. We did also look at the adaptive stuff in the paper, but for now we'll just look at the uniform. Okay.
So how's the maximum T set?
So the T is based essentially the time that you're going to be observing patients for. So if that's based on the particular class of therapies you're looking at, other trials that may have been conducted, you may say, okay, well, we need to follow these patients up for 12 weeks, or some evidence suggests that we need to follow them up for 18 weeks for DLTs or something shorter. So that's usually a clinical parameter that's chosen. Okay, so all we're going to be doing here in this slide is tweaking some of the stuff that we've used in the PIPE design already. So we've got our prior distributions for our risks of DLT at each of these doses, and so as was sort of brought up earlier about choosing the priors, we can choose these parameters, so they're centred on prior medians, and that we're assuming that a very vague belief, essentially, that one patient has been dosed across all of the dose levels we're considering. And for each dose combination, we're going to have a number of DLTs, which is expressed by summing up all the weights of patients that have been dosed with that treatment. So this includes people that have had DLTs whilst they're on that particular treatment, but also people where they completed some of their follow-up but haven't finished their DLT observation yet. And similarly, we've got the converse as well for the number of non-DLTs. This will include patients that have completed their follow-up and also patients that are still being followed up. And then the updating procedure is exactly the same as we had previously. So we're just using the conjugate properties of the beta prior and the binomial likelihood to basically say that the posterior probability distribution for each combination we have is the prior stuff we assumed plus the DLTs observed at time t. And I say DLTs because that is people who definitely have a DLT and some patient weights for people on their dose. And also then we've got this other parameter, the other hyperparameter has been updated here. So this is basically using time-specific DLTs and or making the assumption, more importantly, that patients who haven't had a DLT yet have some sort of weight towards a DLT. So for example, if a patient's been observed for 70% of their follow-up, then they have a 70% or 0.7 weight towards non-DLTs and 0.3 towards DLTs. That's probably the best way to explain it. So basically, as they're getting followed up more and more and more, that DLT weight goes down. So what does this mean, really, sort of practically, when it comes to conducting the trials? Well, I've just got two plots here to show. The top one is showing an example of what would happen under the PIPE design. What we're doing is observing patients for one time unit, and time is on the x-axis here. You can see the patient index is up there, and we have the doses that they've been allocated to under a particular trial. So we've got the first patient coming in, they're observed for one time unit. Now patient two has been recruited at about 0.8 time units, but we can't decide what to do with them until patient one has completed their follow-up. So they have a bit of a wait around. Then patient two comes on, they get observed. Similarly for patient three, they come in at about one time unit, but we have to wait until patient two has completed follow-up. You see what I'm getting at here, basically that all these patients are going to have to wait a bit. Whereas if we can include some partial data, make some assumptions about essentially how much of a DLT we're ascribing to patients who are still in follow-up, then we can start considering to put patients on the trial a bit quicker. Now there's two things you'll notice here. The first thing is that these patients still have to wait around a bit. We, in our work, use the rule that you have to have at least one patient who's been assigned and has completed treatment on a particular dose before you can start treating people on new doses. This is something that just came out of clinical discussions, that they wouldn't want to start putting loads and loads of patients on a dose that you've got hardly any data on the previous doses. And the second thing is that this patient here under this this example has received dose combination 1-3, but this person up here received 1-4. So why is that? Well, if we think about it here, we've got, at this point in time when we're going to put patient 6 on treatment, we've got hardly any data on patient 5, but we've got, you know, no data. So their weight is going to be pretty much 1 for DLTs. So at the moment, this patient is almost being treated as if patient 5 has had a DLT, so we're being a bit more cautious and we're putting patient 6, they're going to start on combination 1-3 rather than combination 1-4. So this is going to be a slightly more conservative design in terms of the speed at which you're escalating through the doses, because you're assuming that for the portion of time you've not followed people up, that's a DLT. So it's a bit of a conservative assumption. But we'll look at some simulation results in a moment and we'll see how it compares.
So it's sort of slightly, I think, about one time unit quicker with the time type and on the time.
In this example, so that's 6 patients, you are, absolutely. Yes. And of course, it could be the case that you, you know, you may want to forego that constraint if you were really daring, or you may want to have more patients treated at particular doses, in which case the type pipe would be fairly similar to pipe. And of course, if you've got a larger trial, rather than just 6 patients here, you've got 20, 30, 40, then all of those time-saving bits could add up to being a much quicker and cheaper trial.
So the more you've got going on, perhaps the more confident you can be about, you know, what dosage you could put a patient on, it might be a sort of speeding up effect, possibly. I don't know.
Well, I suppose, so that's the goal, really, I suppose, is can we speed up a trial without really compromising too much on the accuracy with which we determine the maximum tolerated dose. So you are absolutely right, you know, so it's trying to get the benefits out of speeding something up, but not at the cost of basically having a really crap trial. So that's what we're trying to do here. Okay. So I've talked about safety constraints already, but for some of this work, we basically assumed fairly similar things to what we've done before. We have a constraint where basically if the risk of a DLT occurring at the lowest combination, that should be a high there, but if the risk of DLT occurring at the lowest dose, the risk of the probability of DLT being above the MTC, so our contour, if that exceeds some threshold, some epsilon, then we can stop the trial for safety concerns. That's basically saying, look, the lowest dose isn't safe, so we're not going to treat any more patients on this. And that's using patients that have completed all of their follow-up. And we could be in a situation where we don't have any doses that are feasible to give patients because we've still got some patients in follow-up at the moment and we need to wait until they're completed. So we'd say in that case, okay, we're not going to put patients onto a particular dose, we're going to wait until all patients still in follow-up have completed their DLT observation, and then we'll reassess. Does a combination become available to treat someone at, or actually are we fairly certain that, yep, this trial is going to stop for safety reasons? So these are two other safety constraints. And this is something that Ethan Ogre and colleagues use in one of their papers as well. Okay, so that's sort of the extension to the pipe design that's used for ORCA 2, and just, you know, framing it in a time-to-event setting. So now we're going to look at some simulation results. So we use 7 different dose toxicity scenarios for our work. So these were taken from Braun and Gia's papers. You've basically got 2 drugs here. I know the ORCA 2 trial is dose and days, but we're going to use 2 drugs. We've got 4 doses of each drug here. We've got should be the probabilities, and they're written here as integers here for the risk of DLT. And we've got a target toxicity level of 20%. So this these lines that you see here basically bisect the safe and the unsafe doses. So we've got a range of scenarios, some cutting through here, one where everything is safe, one where everything is unsafe, and a few sort of quite asymmetric shapes as well. Okay, so we're going to assume the patients all start on the lowest combination, and the study starts at time zero, and patients are followed up for one time unit. So capital T in this case equals one. So whether your unit is a month, 2 months, 10 weeks, whatever. And they're followed up until they've completed that window or until a DLT happens, whichever happens first. Now, in our simulations, we assumed that patients arrive at one of three arrival rates, so which it's basically a Poisson process where lambda is equal to a half, one, or two. So we can think of where the lambda is two, that is where two patients are arriving every time unit on average. So there's a lot faster recruitment. When it's one, that's kind of as expected. We expect one patient per time unit. And when it's a half, we're actually expecting a lot slower recruitment. So I mentioned about sort of requiring a certain number of patients on each of the, on a particular combination before we can consider dosing patients. So for both designs, we required there was a minimum of two patients to have completed treatment on each open dose combination before new decisions are made. So what does that mean? So for the pipe design, it basically meant we needed at least two patients on a combination, and we completely follow them up until we could dose another patient. And under tight pipe, it basically meant that we required complete follow-up on two patients per cohort before allowing partial data to be used. So if we had two patients at combination 1-1, we follow those up, the next patient would come along. If they were going to be treated at 1-1 as well, which is entirely possible, and then a future patient came along, we could use the partial data from that third patient to help inform what's going on. So really, that sounds quite restrictive. We're going to have to wait for two patients who have completed treatment before we can start using this kind of new methodology and trying to speed up the trial. But it can be adapted to be as conservative or as lax as you like. And also that for small dose toxicity grids, you're going to end up meeting that requirement fairly quickly, so then you can start using partial data a bit more. So this is just sort of one of the constraints that we put on the recruitment process in our work. For each scenario, so we had seven scenarios, we did 2,000 simulations. We had 40 patients as the maximum sample size, and we used that early stopping rule that I mentioned about the risk of where the DLT risk at the lowest combination, so if the lowest combination was above the target and that was a high probability of that, we'd stop the trial. So we calibrated that as about 80%. And to do all this stuff, we used some existing code in R. There's an R package called Pipe Design, which was published with Mike and Adrian's original paper, and this code has been modified and is going to be put onto the latest edition of that package. Now, we had to also assume how the toxicities were occurring in our trial. So were they occurring at a uniform rate, or were they all early onset toxicities, or were they late onset toxicities? So we assumed three distributions for that. So we've got on the left here, we've got the PDFs of a uniform distribution, so that's that yellow line going across there. We've got Pareto distributions, so that's basically representing early onset toxicities. And we've also got a Weibull distribution here representing late onset toxicities. So this is basically just to provide a bit of a sensitivity analysis to see do either of these designs perform noticeably differently when toxicities are happening at a slightly different rate. Okay, so now we come on to some of the results. So first off, we're going to look at three key things. We're going to look at the experimentation percentage. So that's basically for combinations that have a true risk of DLT within these brackets here. How often are we dosing patients at them? Remember, our target toxicity level was 20%. So we can see here, I'm not going to go through sort of all of these in detail, but scenario A was a fairly sort of standard one and matches up with our prior beliefs. So we're looking at about 60% or 63% of patients are being dosed within sort of a target range, if you like. We've got a little bit of overdosing under some of the tight pipes, a little bit of underdosing there. So this is kind of as expected. Under the tight pipe approaches, because we're being a bit more conservative, there's a weight of the DLT in someone that hasn't completed their follow-up. then we're putting slightly more patients at lower dose combinations, or combinations that have a risk of DLT lower than the target. Now, in terms of expected sample sizes, it's all fairly standard, and we've got mean DLTs here on the side as well. Now, the scenario D, that was the one that was unsafe in all dose levels, so there was excessively high toxicity. So we had, I'll come to the recommendations in a bit, so this looks like basically we dosed all of our patients across all 2,000 simulations at those high doses, but a lot of the trials stopped early, that's shown in the recommendation figures. So that's what we're looking at for the first four scenarios, and then the remaining three as well. We've got some mixtures there, and you'll see there's a zero, a column of zeros appearing here, purely because there were no dose combinations that had a risk of DLT between 25% and 34% of that situation. So that's the experimentation, so that's basically looking at where patients are allocated across all of those simulated trials. The recommendation is probably the one of a bit more interest, because that's basically saying how often are we picking dose combinations that have a risk of DLT within our target range, or even above our target range. In all honesty, there's not a lot of difference between the approaches that we're seeing. So if you look at scenario A, we're looking at about sort of 73-74% of trials are recommending doses within that target range, and similarly for the underdose and overdose, they're fairly similar as well. I suppose ones of interest might be looking at scenario D again. So this is one where everything was pretty unsafe. So we did have some trials where recommendations were made, and were made at dose levels that had this risk of DLT. But we had a lot of trials, so 96% roughly, that were stopping before a maximum tolerated dose was declared. So that's basically saying, okay, nothing was safe, we're stopping the trial early. And similarly, again, looking at those last three scenarios, E, F, and G, we're seeing fairly similar results across the approaches as well. So even if we're using partial follow-up and trying to speed up the trial a bit, or if we're using the pipe approach as it was proposed, we're not really changing too much in terms of our operating characteristics. We're not sacrificing too much at this point. But then the key thing, I suppose, is thinking about, okay, well, what about trial duration? You know, how long are these trials taking? They're taking just as long or if longer? What's happening there? So what we've got here is a table summary for each scenario and each design and the arrival rates that were used in our simulations. What was the average trial duration that we saw? So you can see that when the recruitment rate is 0.5, so that is basically recruitment is much slower than expected, there's hardly any difference at all. It's pretty much the same, because patients are arriving at such a slow rate, the methods are behaving in the same way. When patients are arriving as expected, tight pipe can sort of capitalise on the fact there's going to be a slight difference, or you know, some people will be arriving earlier on average and some people arriving later. Again, we're not really saving that much in terms of efficiency there. The main things we're seeing is when recruitment is much faster than expected, we're seeing that we're looking at an average of 30 time units under pipe for some of these scenarios going down to 20, and that's pretty much, you know, sort of a saving of about a third in terms of the construction here. Yes? Question.
Yes,
yeah, sure.
When the recruitment is slow, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And when the recruitment is fast, it should not be matter anyway because it's faster recruitment.
Faster, but bear in mind, under the pipe approach here, we're waiting for patients to have completed all of their follow-up.
Yeah,
so even when patients are coming in, they're sort of standing there going, what dose am I going to receive? And they're not put onto treatment yet. Whereas under when we're trying to incorporate these time-to-event outcomes, admittedly with some constraints on the recruitment, as I've mentioned, we're saying, okay, well, we're at a point now where, as a patient, have we satisfied all the rules that mean I can go on to treatment. You don't have to wait for those previous people to completely have completed all of their follow-up. So we're only really seeing the saving absolutely when we've got much faster recruitment than expected. Now, that's not that common in a lot of trials. You will get something like fast recruitment, that's brilliant. But it does happen every now and then. But yeah, you're absolutely spot on. When it's slower recruitment, there's not much difference.
Scenario D is sort of a lot lower, isn't it?
Yeah, so scenario D was the one where everything was unsafe. So there'll be a lot of trials stopping earlier anyway, so you won't get the full 40 patients that we were planning for on that
because
trial.
You've got a smaller length, you've got smaller because they're all stopping. You can't
so the average sample size, I think, was about 19 patients for that scenario. Yeah. So that's why you're seeing that smaller number there.
Do you ever look at a design where, as soon as they come in, you allocate them to the same dose?
Yeah, so we did. So in the paper, so this one is quite a nice one because it's kind of trying to mirror it as is realistic, as what we would normally do in our unit. We did have a look at one as saying, okay, whenever a patient arrives, boom, they're on treatment, and that's what happens. And yeah, you get much, sort of, the trial duration efficiency is obviously comparable, if not slightly better than this, but you do see a bit of a drop in terms of the operating characteristics with recommendation accuracy and experimentation, because you're basically saying, well, I've got hardly any data on these patients, but I'm still going to make a decision about where they go. But yeah, but that's all in the paper.
There's also been increase in resources.
Yeah, you've got to think about what you're actually going to be learning from those patients if you're just going to be popping them on very, very low doses, just because they're there. So that's the main things that we saw from this sort of stuff. So it is possible to basically kind of match or get fairly similar operating characteristics by treating your outcomes slightly differently. And under certain scenarios, you can save a whole bunch of time and potentially money. So just to summarise, so incorporating this sort of outcome, it's not a great leap really. Most of the structure was there in terms of work that had been done by Mike and Adrian. A lot of the adaptations to phase one trial work is ultimately thinking about, okay, well, what sort of outcomes are we seeing and how can we make things a bit more realistic? Incorporating these partial outcomes and this sort of partially weighted data can easily be done with things like PIPE, and it really helps that it's a conjugate network, like a conjugate makeup. So you've got your beta distributions for your priors and your binomial likelihoods, and it all just works fine. As we've seen in the scenarios that I've shown you there, there's comparable operating characteristics in terms of experimentation recommendation, and we are able to save in some instances on trial duration. The weight function didn't really matter that much. I showed you sort of the examples of that adaptive weight function, and the idea is that when you start seeing DLTs in your trial, that changes what weights are given to patients that come onto your study. That didn't really matter whether you're using something complex like that or whether you were just assuming a uniform weight over time. And in terms of a practical thing, so the code is available online with the article, which I've got a link for on the next slide. But we are going to be aiming to incorporate that into the next PIPE design release as well. And I had a few thoughts about sort of future research and, I suppose, limitations of this work as well. Now, a couple of things that could be done for things like this is having a must-observe observation window. So I know there's a trial coming out of the Birmingham Clinical Trials Unit called Wisteria, which Christina Yap is working on there. And she says that basically they have a 12-week follow-up period where they're looking at patients for 12 weeks if they have a DLT or not, but they will have to have data on them for at least 8 weeks before they make a decision. So you're using a similar structure to this whole sort of time-to-event thing. But at the same time, you've basically blocked off two-thirds of that time to say, we need to observe that before we make a decision. So that's something that's happening in this Wisteria trial here, so maybe that's something that could feature in this sort of research. Will it make a difference or not? I'm not so sure. We considered 4x4 dose toxicity grids. How feasible or how useful is this methodology where you've got much larger dose toxicity grids as well? As we saw, you know, the number of contours can really blow up, so does that have an impact on operating characteristics? One thing that I also thought about is that what we did with the risks of DLT at each of those combinations is we assumed the same weight on each of the combinations was, you know, 1/16th of a patient, and we assumed that one patient was average over the whole grid. What about, though, how does that then transform into the weights that we assume before the study starts on the maximum tolerated contours? So are some contours more likely than others? And wouldn't it be better or interesting to see, okay, well, let's actually have a uniform weighting across all possible contours and then conduct a trial that way? So how would that change? And some work, not in this framework, but some work from Other statisticians has been done with functional uniform prior, so that might be something to work with this. We didn't have a look at any other approaches out there that look at combination methods, which are also using time to event outcomes that might use dose toxicity models. Known Wages from the University of Virginia has done a bit of work on this. So I think it would only be fair, really, to see how this sort of stuff compares with the performance of that as well. And finally, there's a real drive to try and get as much out of patients as possible in terms of the data that they are able to provide and what we can learn from new treatments. So is there feasibly a way where we can start to use efficacy outcomes in these early phase trials as well as toxicity data? And that's probably going to be of far more interest, especially where the assumptions that as you increase your dose, toxicity increases or the efficacy increases may not hold true for certain drugs. There's a whole sort of realm of targeted agents and immunotherapy and things where some of those assumptions may not hold true, or you may end up having an efficacy relationship or a toxicity relationship that plateaus. So how is that going to hold up with this sort of thing? We're not quite sure. So this is the paper. So it came out in a journal earlier this year. And the whole link for the code and stuff is actually in the paper itself, but these slides will be available afterwards and you can double check my code and find the bugs. But just a couple of quick thank yous to Mike Sweeting at the University of Leicester and Adrian as well, thank you. And to acknowledge some funding as well, so MRC, NIHR, the British Heart Foundation and Cancer Research UK all had roles to play in this. And I know we've had some questions, but I'd be happy to take on any more that you guys might have. So I will leave it there.
Yes, well, I mean, I suppose if you were using them, you'd probably use the tight pipe rather than the pipe, because the tight pipe is always going to be at least as quick. It's better than the tight pipe. You can, it's going to be quicker because you can use the partial information with a tight pipe, which you can't with a pipe.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and yeah. I don't think, in terms of just thinking from sort of practically from in a trials unit or a trials perspective, it's not that much extra effort to kind of logistically introduce. Because all you really need is like, okay, well, when do patients start treatment? What's the date today? And when should they have ended their DLT follow-up and what's their DLT status? That's the information we're working with here to implement this design. So yes, you need perhaps a bit of statistical expertise and, you know, maybe to work out what the best trial design is, but in terms of like the ongoing conduct of the trial, there's not major tweaks that I don't think you need. So yeah, so maybe I would angle towards that.
But could a non-statistician, I mean, now it's in R, you know, perhaps, because I know, like, I know the randomization has to be done by someone who's no, you know, but something like this, perhaps you might want to get the clinician doing, you know,
it's a good point. So there's a real shift with having basically sort of graphic user interfaces to R packages, for particularly in phase one trials. So there's me and Nolan Wages, who I mentioned, are doing a session on this at a PSI conference in London, and I know that for the Shiny, for the Pipe package, so Pipe design, there is a Shiny interface. So that is basically you load it up in R, run it, and you basically get presented with sliders, text boxes, things that you can input in, and it does all the background work for you. Now, I'm sure something could easily be done with the time to event approach of this as well. Whether a clinician would be tempted to use it or just be having a play around going, okay, well, maybe I understand parts of the design would be useful, I'm not sure. But it would definitely make it a lot more approachable and a lot easier for other statisticians who are involved in trial design to say, okay, well, I heard about this approach, or this is a new method. I'll have a play around with it. I can learn from it, and I can do this sort of thing. So there is a bit of a movement for that. Maybe not from the clinicians to do that, but definitely other statisticians. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, I let you go.
Okay, the back.
So, I mean, obviously, one thing you did mention was that, I mean, this is particularly applicable to trials where there's a combination with radiotherapy. Because the course of radiotherapy is quite long, and that's why these specific trials, the DLT window, is actually much longer than it would be for a drug study.
Yes.
Specifically. But the other thing was, in combination with the olaparib, they're giving radiation and cisplatin as well.
Yeah.
It struck me that the prior estimates of DLT may actually have been a little bit low. And I just wondered, has that been the case, or how has this progressed?
So I'm not sure how much I can say, because the trial's still going at the moment. So I can't say
too. Two statisticians, so you can't say anything.
I know.
But in terms of, so just commenting on sort of, in a hypothetical example, how this would work, or actually for the Orca 2 itself,
well, I
price specification.
I mean, you were giving a standard therapy, which is probably being given at very close to the maximum tolerated dose, and yet I think your prior estimate was 0.1 or something for
the
start
of the
dose.
So
you almost predict that you're not going to get much further than your start dose with that study, simply because of the toxicity of the standard agent.
So it's a really good point. So we've got all these different treatments that are sort of together, and if one is being given pretty close to its single agent MTD, shouldn't those price be higher? What we, because we've assumed quite a bit of variability around those prior guesses, so it says, you know, 0.1 or 0.12 on that particular dose combination, but at the same time there's a lot of variability around that estimate as well, so that when new data does come in, and if it does come up that, you know, there is DLTs further on, then it can update sort of fairly sensibly. So I think it is about trying to think about what is a sensible prior estimate in terms of a median or mean rate of toxicity, but also just being prepared in terms of how precise are you willing to say that is.
You really should be pitching this as a combination of radiotherapy where the time window is quite big, because it would be very useful.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you.
I have to apologize first, because I would ask you a very naive question, because I've never done or seen any of the clinical trial design talk. So I understand that the goal of this study is to estimate the contour line of the DLT. Is it the goal?
Yeah, maximum tolerated contour. Yeah, that's right.
And it's when you test or estimate your model, it's based on the starting point of that point of that patient, right? So that's this trajectory where, like, the history of this in this two line.
Yeah.
Does it affect?
So
whether it's from this way or the other way.
I see what you mean. Yeah. So if we've got a I was about to.
Because it's only.
If we're here, we can either go up here, along there, or diagonally up there, and is the question basically, so how does that affect?
No.
So
it's the history of that point. So because theoretically, I know that this is trial one, so the goal is to decide the line, but realistically, you have to, when you treat a patient, you have to understand that that patient has been treated with this dose previously.
Yeah.
How many days and this much. So this, in this case, in a way, it's like, what is that degree, the order one Markov chain kind of design.
Oh, it's,
but
yeah.
Does the other history, memory of that?
So we are, okay, so maybe, so I didn't make this clear, so what we're assuming as well, is, maybe this will answer, is that we're assuming that these are brand new patients coming in. So a patient is assigned to, you know,
yes, I could understand the based on the plot.
Yeah.
But in reality,
yeah,
that patient that you would gradually increase or somehow
sometimes
it
you
doesn't.
Yeah, no, sometimes you would and sometimes you wouldn't. So for a lot of our trials we don't have intrapatient dose escalation. Mm-hmm. So patients receive a dose and they're gonna be treated, you know, on, you know, day zero and day nine, and then followed up for however longer. And they may have some maintenance therapy alongside. But we may not be increasing or changing the doses within patients. Once a patient has a DLT, it's fairly standard to assume that they're coming off treatment because they need care to help either reverse the side effects or to look after them. But it's a good point that if we were treating patients and changing doses within patients, and we're actually escalating within them, then this framework would have to become a whole lot more complex. And we really have to think about the history of the patient, what they've received so far, and how they, as an individual, tolerated it, rather than just like the group itself and how many patients we've got there. Is that what you're getting at, sort of that we are changing doses within patients?
And if you make a model based on that, I understand that this is only a goal line, but if you model that previous history of conditional probability, then would it be independent? Like the first choice would be independent, so you would multiply the two probabilities.
Yeah.
However, they would probably interact, and then because this design is you assume that the patient hasn't been treated, or all those things inside the body has been decayed, and then
there's no cumulative build-up. Absolutely. So you really would have to, you know, if we were trying to be smart about it, we'd have to try and build in some sort of mechanism to model cumulative dose, number of cycles they had previously received, and at what levels they were as well. And if we really wanted to go into sort of the nitty-gritty of it, there's only so much we can do with a 40-patient trial and all these sorts of things. But also, you know, at the start of the talk I mentioned that toxicity is occurs across several grades, you know, 1 to 4, 5 to death. And there's different adverse events as well. So if you know, we could say, okay, well, you know, grade 3 and higher is dose limiting, but surely people having dose grade 1 or grade 2 responses, toxicities, that's probably fairly informative of the toxicity activity of different combinations as well. Sorry I took ages to get to understand that, but it's a really good point, actually, just thinking about what patients might be going through. Yeah. Thank you.
I was just going to think, with the ORCA trial, maybe you might not be able to tell us the results, but maybe you tell us what Lambda's looking like.
Pretty slow. Yeah.
So Lambda's less than 1 then.
If you average across the whole trial, yes, but if you look at it at certain points, it goes, you know, okay, yeah.
Big team was 1, so it's all relative to your observation period.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So that's why the when it was lambda equals 1, that was as expected, because we're expecting 1 patient per DLT window, per time unit. Yeah.
So I was thinking kind of like individually, but I think it's related to that question. So I was wondering, I can imagine that the neighboring athletes, maybe dependent also. I understand that a posteriori they're dependent, but I wonder if it's worth doing them a priori, perhaps using the Dirichlet or the Rollins or Collins.
So going back to when we assumed independent pies, whether there is actually some dependence.
I think everything you do can be done.
Yeah, it's fairly similar in terms of updating and things.
And you could kind of borrow some words like over neighbouring.
I think that sounds entirely possible. You're still working in sort of a, you know, sort of model-free environment, but you are borrowing, as you said, borrowing information across doses or across days.
You need to think of the constraints.
Yeah. Yeah, so you'd have to probably end up trying to think, really. Yeah, I imagine there'll be some nitty-gritty things that would come out of it, but at the same time, there could potentially be some benefit. Then that was something that we ever discussed, really, was it?
Sylvia said very early on, I don't think you...
Really?
You said, I said, we want to make it simple, then. If this is simple. You don't have any model at all. You don't say there's some continuous function.
Right.
So your contours that follow a function, they're entirely determined by your data, by all these independent.
There's a lot of approaches out there where they'll basically be trying to model the entire dose toxicity surface and
make a risk model.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, not a combination. I mean, if you think of single trials. Here we are thinking of the evaluation of something rather and then in the previous one back. Is that the philosophy of it? Is kind of algorithm based how does it work? Because I'm just trying to think how do you make that grid?
Well, the grid's predetermined, isn't it, by whatever dose combination you have.
Yeah.
How do you calculate the contour is in that formula, which isn't, although it has like independent distributions at every dose combination, when you multiply them all together, it does tell you it is structures. There's different tails below and above. So it isn't totally independent when you work out the property of each contour. But it's remarkably informative, mostly. We were a bit surprised when we did it.
The real benefits of, well, sort of, you did some work in the original pipe design, the old paper, and the real benefits there, if I recall correctly, were basically when you had a very odd dose toxicity sort of surface underneath it, so very asymmetric, or, you know, if you escalated one treatment, it did nothing to the toxicity, but if you went the other way and escalated the other treatment, toxicity shot up. And that was something that the models couldn't really deal with.
Because assuming most models are smooth, so they can't deal with anything very jagged, whereas this obviously does something. If you don't want to make an assumption about any sort of smooth curve surface, then it does remarkably well. Surprisingly well for such a simple concept.
And another question for the original pipe design. You showed very well how this pipe, what are the improvements on pipe if you have these types of elements. I usually thinking about type, I just don't use pipe. From a clinical perspective, what you think, I don't know, those the two drugs or drugs of every therapy, that might be two things. What I would naively, so my question is that all these advantages are kind of at the expense of transference. So as soon as we include those Bayesian models for everyone except for statistician, it becomes a black box. So originally, yeah, just accept. If I was a clinician, I would, and if I was looking at this 20%, I would do the following naive design. I would take the minimal, obviously, say, maximally safe minimal doses. I will run five first patients, one after one, obviously not simultaneously. And as soon as I reach two out of five, for me it's threshold that it's more than 20%. As simple as this. If I have one patient, I don't have a side effect, I'm still up worried. If I got TL5, I put tick in this box, and then I'm randomly assigned another 10 patients, 5 up and 5 to right. And my procedure is the same. As soon as I have 3 dots, I am going diagonal. So this is a simple, naive, and very transparent approach, because at this point, each time for each stupid clinician, you can explain why you did this selection. Because it's very small quantities of patients, if you compare this naive, clearly for clinician design to your pipe, could you have the same sort of comparison? Will you come to the same outcome? How fast it will be? What will be the advantage?
Joe, you're talking about having lots of data. If you have lots of data, you can hit that 20%, or you can clearly see that's above 20% and that looks unsafe. So dealing with much less data, you wouldn't have such a clear picture as that. But if you did have more than 20% of DLTs in a certain dose combination, that will be unsafe. So because there isn't a model distorting the actual data, the data does the driving, you will find as soon as you go above 20%, that dose combination is unsafe. But what it does in terms of this contour, it does inform something around your neighbours where that contour should lie. If you haven't been somewhere, then you're just, in your case, you still don't know anything. So it is informing something about the neighbourhood. So you're getting a little bit more information. So although you think, I agree, it's using, a Bayesian posterior, which isn't,
to use it in the court.
Transparent, but if you look at the data that comes from a trial, it will. But that contour will map exactly where you look at the data, and you would draw it yourself. It would draw it, so it would match what you can see. It's very transparent. Whereas a model, I think it might not. The contour from a model might not fit the data, and you might not believe it or start ignoring it and start doing those decisions based on some other decision criteria. So, I don't
question?
Look, he doesn't care.
No, I thought you were just trying to persuade us to do the contour.
No, I mean, I think that what we want to see is based on carbon emissions. We want to see the minimum number of patients treated at those levels that are the biologically affected dose. So you want models that don't set the base level confidently as a non-toxic level. You want to try and push those escalations to the future.
But you have to accept something that you don't quite understand, though. Is that, are you happy to do that? Because you're dosing patients, right?
Yeah, I mean,
you trust us.
We're treating diseases every day where we don't fully understand. So,
I mean, I think that's an excellent discussion for the audience. But I mean, inspired by Graham. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
If anyone wants them, please don't feel obliged. I'm collecting stuff for our treasurer. Just £1 for the session. And I've got the bag here and the list of names here. I'll leave it there if you wish, but please don't feel obliged. Right.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Peter.
That's excellent. I mean.
Excellent. Right. Oh, gosh, yes. Oh, gosh. Oh, hang on.